Listen local.
From WJFF,
live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, American Freak Show. It's a weekly newsletter from veteran journalist Nina Burley, keeping an eye on MAGA extremism and its absurdity. She's here with reaction to the election and what Trump 2.0 might look like, plus a preview of a conversation she'll have about her debut novel, Sunday at the Derby. New York declares drought watch for 15 counties, including Delaware, Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange. We'll speak to the Department of Environmental Protection about what it means for local residents and conserving water, plus an update on the Delaware Aqueduct. Janice Adams is here with more election reaction and honoring veterans at the Damascus School. Coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Biden is expected to make remarks this morning about this week's presidential election. He has already called to congratulate President-elect Donald Trump. Vice President Harris did the same yesterday when she called Trump to concede the election. Meanwhile, NPR's Asma Khalid says Biden officials are looking to preserve some elements of the administration's climate legislation.
Biden's really proud of that big climate bill passed back in 2022, the Inflation Reduction Act. And Republicans have already talked about rescinding elements of the law, specifically the tax credits for people who want to purchase electric vehicles could go up, or the incentives to build electric charging infrastructure. I mean, there's not a whole lot that the Biden White House could do to protect this, but they've been trying to tout the bill's popularity in spurring manufacturing projects in Republican congressional districts, hoping that that will somehow protect the bill from being repealed.
NPR's Asma Khalid reporting. Republicans will control the Senate in the next congressional session, holding at least 52 seats. It's not yet clear who will control the House of Representatives. There are dozens of very close House races yet to be called. Israel's parliament has passed a law today that would allow for the deportation of family members of Palestinian attackers. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more from Tel Aviv.
The law would allow for family members of attackers to be deported to places like Gaza, even in the midst of war. It would apply to Palestinian citizens of Israel or residents of East Jerusalem. In the Israeli-occupied West Bank, Israel already regularly punishes family members of attackers. The law, which is likely to be challenged in court, was championed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's party. There's been a rise in attacks by Palestinians in Israel in recent months. Two other laws passed this week that critics worry could be used to target Palestinians. One gives the government power to dismiss teachers who, quote, demonstrate solidarity with terrorist organizations. The other allows for the arrest of children as young as 14. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened higher this morning, adding to yesterday's big post-election gains. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 30 points in early trading.
All the major stock indexes soared to record highs on the day after the election, with the Dow jumping more than 1,500 points. Bond traders were less enthusiastic about the political outcome. The yield on 10-year treasuries jumped sharply on concerns that President-elect Trump's policies could add trillions of dollars in new federal debt. While long-term borrowing costs are rising, the Federal Reserve is expected to cut short-term interest rates this afternoon by a quarter percentage point. The move comes as inflation inches closer to the central bank's 2% target and the job market shows signs of slowing. Central banks in the UK and Sweden also cut interest rates today. New claims for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. In Germany, the opposition party is calling for an immediate election to replace the government. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Berlin. Germany's coalition government collapsed yesterday over a dispute about economic reform.
With Germany's three-party coalition down to two parties and a minority government, opposition leader Friedrich Merz of the center-right CDU party has called on Chancellor Olaf Scholz to hold a confidence vote in parliament by the end of next week. Scholz, who fired his finance minister, which led to the collapse of his governing coalition, had previously called for that parliamentary vote in mid-January. Should Merz get his way, a new election could be held by late January, paving the way for a new government by next spring. That's something German politicians believe is important, given the country's role in supporting Ukraine, now that former President Donald Trump, who who threatened during campaigning to cut U.S. aid to Ukraine, has been elected the next U.S. president. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Forecasters say Hurricane Rafael is about 180 miles northwest of Havana, Cuba. Rafael made landfall in Cuba as a Category 3 storm with winds around 115 miles per hour. It knocked out the island's power with wind, rain, and flooding. Rafael has since dropped to a Category 2 storm in the Gulf of Mexico. California fire officials say the so-called mountain fire has burned a little more than 20 square miles northwest of Los Angeles. But many people have had to flee, and multiple homes have burned. Thousands more are in danger. The fire is being fueled by the Santa Ana winds, very dry and gusty, making fire conditions worse. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Total Wine & More. For discovering something new, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila, learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Nina Burley is a journalist, best-selling author, documentary producer, and publisher of a Substack on politics called American Freak Show, which keeps an eye on MAGA extremism. Her debut novel is Zero Visibility Possible, based on the true story of the 2017 mass shooting in Las Vegas. She'll be in conversation with journalist Ilya Meritz on Sunday at 3 at the Darby, just across from the bridge in from Narrowsburg, New York, in a special conversation from One Grand Books. She's joining us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm going to just read the headline in your Substack, American Freak Show, The Unforgiven. This is who we are. This is who we are. This is who we've elected.
This is who we are. This is who we've elected. And, in the lead up to this election, I kept saying to myself and to, you know, all of the friends and family who discussed this endlessly, is that, you know, if he wins, the only conclusion to be drawn is that this is who our country is. It wasn't a stolen election. The Democrats could have probably put up a better fight. I mean, we can talk about that if you want to, the mistakes that were made, that have been made for many years, in dealing with certain parts of our country. But it's who we are. And a majority of Americans decided to elect a man who is an adjudicated sexual abuser, who's accused by, several dozen women of oafish, if not, abusive behavior. And furthermore, under indictment, federally and in state courts. And whose plans are to really, really remake the government in a way that our country has never seen before. And he's aided and abetted by the 6th majority in the Supreme Court. So we're looking ahead at some, kind of cataclysmic, if not catastrophic, situation here.
I want to talk about what that's going to look like, but also want to just go back to this core idea of, like, this is who we are, which you address in the beginning of the Substack article, which is basically that we are the richest country on earth, yet we're still afraid. We still want to bar the door, I think you say here too, and it's not enough. And so it gets to the core of why folks decided to vote this way.
Yeah, I mean, yes, part of it is that we're afraid of these outsiders, this strong stream of nativism in our country, or xenophobia, that's been plied, poked, and provoked by this candidate, Trump, now president for the second time since he began in politics in 2015, blaming Mexican rapists for the problems of this country. But what I was trying to get at in that column yesterday is that, anybody who's traveled outside of this country into parts of the world that are less fortunate than us, or even into places like Europe and other Western industrialized nations, you come away understanding just how privileged we are, just how rich this country is. We have cheap gas. We have endless amounts of processed food and unprocessed food. We have gadgets and games and diversions and cars. And you know, the average American is so far ahead of the average human on this planet in terms of being cared for and having access to material goods. And I think that what happened here is that people are not, you know, material goods and cheap things do not equal happiness. And the Fox News effect and the Republican assault on fact has really been able to persuade a large number of people that their unhappiness has to do with the, you know, the way that the Democrats have been running the country. And that simply isn't true. We are a very, very spoiled nation. We are very, very spoiled people. We have access to a lot of things and we don't appreciate them. That's my opinion.
Well, and you also write in this column in your Substack, American Freak Show, quote, with unfulfilled desire as a baseline mass psychology, the white right-wing media ecosystem has easily brainwashed more than half the country into believing that we are living in, quote, the worst inflation in American history and the worst economy in history. Everything is dark and bleak.
Yes, and that's what that is actually the tactic, the messaging that Trump has been, again, applying since his first presidency, at the end of the first presidency, in the beginning of the presidency. His first inaugural speech was, you know, this dark vision of America. And the dark vision of America has been going, has been coming out of his mouth ever since. And people who watch Fox, which is 40% of the population, apparently, have been fed nightly this kind of propaganda about, let's say, you know, chaos in blue cities. So, you know, if you look at the map, the electoral map yesterday, you can see that enormous pieces of our country are red. They're red, they're Republican voting, and they're rural. They're places where people are not living close together. We here in our community are not that far from New York City, but I still think there are a lot of people here who are susceptible to the same message, which is they can't believe that you get on the subway. I go in and out of New York City all the time. I bike around New York City after dark. There's, you know, it is not as crime infested as people think it is. But what Fox News did and what Trump has been playing off of is the fear that people have of crime, of, you know, people, brown people coming across the border, maybe Syrians, maybe Iranians, you know, the fantasy of being surrounded by danger in a country like ours, which is literally the most lethally defended country in human history. We are some of the most defended human beings in human history, and yet we live with this constant sense of fear.
Constant fear. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Nina Burley, journalist, best-selling author, and publisher of the Substack American Freak Show, and author of Zero Visibility Possible. She'll be in conversation with journalist Ilya Marritz at the Derby on Sunday at 3, and we'll get to that. But I wanted to let the listener know, in case they weren't completely aware, this is not your first time at the Trump rodeo. You have covered him extensively throughout the years. You wrote the Trump Women book. You write the Substack. You actually also are writing the cover story for the New Republic, talking about his win, yeah, and also talking about what's next. So can you tell us, yeah, a little bit about what to expect in this Trump 2.0?
Yeah. Well, I was tasked with the pre-writing of the Trump Wins cover story. We wrote one for Kamala Wins and one for Trump Wins. And I interviewed about, I don't know, two dozen people, 50 and a half Washington insiders, experts, people at the ACLU, activists, think tank folks, and congresspeople, asking them what they expect to happen when he gets elected, if he got elected, and he is now elected. And, you know, the main takeaway that I got was he and his regime are probably going to inflict shock and awe immediately. They are going to within the minute his hand comes off the Bible, they're going to do probably their firing of the civil servants. Some thousands of them are going to go so that he can replace them with political lackeys who will do what he wants, whether that's legal or not, whether it's breaking norms or not. The second thing they're going to do is probably do a, again, like a shock and awe, lightning strike kind of attack on, I shouldn't say attack, but a roundup of undocumented worker immigrants, probably at workplaces like a meatpacking plant or something, where they're, these people will be rounded up, disappeared into some kind of, gulag system that they're going to set up. And, it'll just be parents not coming home and, children at home and parents just disappearing. And then the third thing, of course, is the beloved, drill baby drill, the perennially popular, open all the public lands to resource extraction. They're probably going to do that quickly by executive order. But the idea that they're going to do shock and awe kind of quick lightning strike so that people get used to this, like, here's what's going to happen. And then eventually, when they have provoked enough people to, the left will go out in the streets and start to protest. And that also plays into the game plan, because they are twitching to invoke the Insurrection Act. You know that this is a man who, he said it repeatedly during the rallies, he would love to bring the military in and do his bidding. And the military is, under the posse comitatus law in this country, forbidden from getting involved in domestic activities. But if they invoke the Insurrection Act, which they can do, if they decide that a protest is an emergency, all bets are off.
And this is based on your sourcing. And this is not.
This
your,
is based on my sourcing. This
not
is
your opinion.
These are people I've talked to. Many, many people. Once Project 2025 was released in last year, there's been a lot of time for lawyers on the progressive side, and organizations, and good government groups and civil society groups like the Brennan Center for Justice and so on. There's been a lot of time for these people to sit down, to get together, to game out what's going to happen. And for example, the ACLU has a day by day, I think hour by hour response plan for what they expect the Trump administration to do, starting from the minute he takes his hand off the Bible.
Let's talk about your upcoming conversation on Sunday with Ilya Meritz. We should mention that Ilya is a board member here at Radio Catskill. We're happy to have him on the board. You'll be in conversation with him. It's a conversation produced and brought to us by One Grand Books, Aaron Hicklin, who also hosts Shelf Life here Sundays at noon. What are you guys going to be talking about? Are you going to be addressing politics here, or are we going to kind of focus on the debut novel, or is it going to be hard to figure out a line here?
Ilya did tell me that he read it and that he liked it, which was very gratifying to me, because Ilya, as you know, is very, very knowledgeable about some of the things in this book. The book is really about, it opens with the infamous Vegas shooting, which is the worst mass shooting in American history. Just one of those blips of horrific violence that have sort of just drifted back into the past, and we don't talk about it anymore, and we don't really understand what happened. And it has spewed all sorts of the event has spawned a lot of conspiracy theories. So I use it as a sort of starting point to the book. And it's really about nominal truth tellers in the media and the legacy media and in Washington, who are trying to figure out what happened against this sort of miasma of disinformation, this fog of lies and fake news allegations that kind of came into being around, or became part of our national discourse around the time that Trump was first elected in 16. So that's what the book is about. It's about disinformation. It's about fake news, the concept of fake news, and it's about using public trauma for political ends.
So there are some parallels.
Yes. I'm a nonfiction writer, but I decided to dive into fiction with this. And I think some things can be said, some truths can be more effectively communicated through fiction.
And this is happening again at the Darby, which is just across the bridge from Narrowsburg there in Beach Lake on the river at 3 on Sunday. Do folks need to register or is it open to folks to come in?
I think it's open. Yeah. I do see that there's a registration link on the online, yeah. But I think you can just walk in.
That is Sunday.
Please come.
Please, yeah. It's Sunday 3 and hear Ilya and Nina talk about the book and also what's going on currently. And can we talk about a silver lining, if there is one?
Yeah, I mean, the silver...
You say stretching for a silver lining.
Yeah, I mean, the silver lining is that, you know, we're a fickle nation, and every 4 years we get a chance to say, boot them out. And if we manage to get through this without the Constitution being fully shredded and we have another election, which I think we will, I don't think that it's going to go that far, but who knows, you know, the good thing is that American people will get another chance to, after 4 more years of this chaos, what we expected, chaos, mayhem, and a lot of cruelty, that, you know, I think that the public sentiment will shift, hopefully. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of pain before that, and that people will recognize that the promises of prosperity from, like, say, you know, in exploding the tariffs on China are not going to solve the problem of the cost of eggs going up.
And it's part of this understanding of what's going on, and you kind of allude to this here when you talk about what's happened in the country to your friends in other countries, that this is who we are, is the message also for folks who may not have gotten the outcome they expected to kind of accept that this is who we are.
That's my message. I mean, why I wrote that, because when I was thinking ahead about what was going to happen, I thought if it happens, this is who we are. The majority of us think that, you know, that having a president who is a strong man and an autocrat is what we want. And there is a great appetite in this country for that right now. And I think we can talk about the reasons why that is. It has to do with, you know, massive economic change and shifts in the industrial in the workforce and so on, digital era, all that. But we'll get into that later.
Nina Burley, journalist, best-selling author, publisher of the Substack on politics, American Freak Show. Debut novel is Zero Visibility Possible, and she'll be in conversation with journalist Ilya Marritz on Sunday at 3 at the Darby in Beach Lake, just across the bridge from Narrowsburg. And thank you so much for joining us. We're grateful for your insight and for coming in.
You're so welcome, and thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Janice Adams from The Janice Adams Show with more reaction. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting. Because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving 4 counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we talk comfort food from around the world with the beloved Yotam Ottolenghi. And we learn about classic German cooking with the wonderful Louisa Weiss. That's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Janice Adams is a journalist, historian, author, and host of the Janice Adams Show here on Radio Catskill, Saturdays at 11. She is joining us now to talk a little bit more about, well, Janice, we were calling it the silly season. Now it seems like it's gotten sillier.
Well, it's gotten painfully silly.
Yeah.
And it's just something that, you know, when I first was thinking about today's segment, I said, well, we did the Mark Twain show. I did an episode with, quote, Mark Twain. It was my third show, so, and we're heading into our 9th season here at WJFF.
Congratulations.
So this was 8 years. Thank you. This is you know, so 8 years ago was the first Trump election. And we did, with the things that were coming out that he was saying, we did an interview with America's greatest author. And I had also done a column about the silly season, which is what historians have traditionally called the presidential election season. And it gets sillier and longer, and but now this year, honestly, it does not seem so funny.
Mm-mm.
Because of the results. And I, anybody listening, I want to be very clear here. If you see me, you'll see that I have a head of gray hair. This is not the first election that I have not agreed with. And I'm just saying I, being symbolic of all the people who are really devastated by this election. But what this election represents is much more than one person or another person, one direction or another person. It's much deeper than that, and it's now much more dangerous than that to those people who are not in the, quote, winning group.
I want to
That's a whole different scenario.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that more. The New York Times today has an article. The headline is, "For Black Women, America Has Revealed to us Her True Self." Can you talk a little bit based on your experience? And as you mentioned, not your first election. What is why the country again has revealed its true self to black women?
Well, I'll say how. And before I get into black women, I just want to make one overview statement about women. When I first started in broadcasting, but when I did my very first real series, my own series, it really launched women's programming, issue-oriented women's programming in the United States, and it was called The World of Women. And in 1973, when I launched that show, very critical year, it was the year of Roe v. Wade, okay? It was the year that the women's movement in general was coming, had achieved its first goal. 1973, I remember there was a film called Every 11 Minutes, and this is a little bit more than you asked, but just follow me on this. Every 11 Minutes. And that referred to every 11 minutes a woman was raped in the United States. At this point in 2024, when we're talking about the rollback of Roe v. Wade, and the return to vulnerability of women for our bodies. Right now, every 68 seconds, an American male or female is sexually assaulted. 82% of juvenile victims of that every 68 seconds, 82% of juvenile victims are female, and 90% of adult victims are adult female. So that's the context in which we then say, now, here I am with a dual consciousness, dual identity. I'm a woman under assault, and I'm now a black person. And, you know, in the spirit of who you get to intimidate, yes, I'm reluctant to say this, but I think I have to. Donald Trump's persistent insistence on mispronouncing Kamala Harris's name was very pivotal, because for us, even those who don't actually remember it, internally we know it. There is that scene in Roots, that what was then extraordinary, and we know it was deeply sanitized, but movie in which Kunta Kinte is being lashed to within an inch of his life for insisting on calling himself his own name, which is Kunta. And he is being lashed to call himself Toby. Even Dr. King refers in his letter from a Birmingham jail to how in America there is this insistence on not giving you the respect of your name. And he said, and he has this extraordinary sentence with 13 clauses of why we can't wait, why we cannot wait for America to change. And one of those clauses is when your mother is never accorded the name, the title Mrs., and when, as a black man, your first name is always boy and your last name nigger. That attack on her name meant a lot. There was the attack on her personhood, and every black woman of superior achievement that he encountered, he calls low IQ. And the third thing is our general humanity as black people, where not only does his now vice president-elect tell a lie about people, Haitian people, so black people, dehumanizing them to say they're eating people's cats and dogs, but worse, we had a population that was willing to believe it. So this election for us is truly internal. It is damaging. We are going to rise, but it is an assault on every fiber of our being.
And women, black women in particular, are the underappreciated heart of the Democratic Party. What do women and people in the Democratic Party need to do to move forward to rise again?
Well, I think I'm going to be blunt about it. I think that white women need to really look at their history and look at themselves and look at the votes that a majority of white women cast for a man who admitted to grabbing women by their genitals. I began this with the statistics on assault on women. We need to look at ourselves when Hillary Clinton should have won. A majority of every other category other than white men, but a majority of black women, black men, Latino women, even Latino men voted for Hillary Clinton. White women voted a majority for Donald Trump, even then. And there's something about this that we really have to, I can't answer that. And it's not even Democrat or Republican. It is, why is the United States so entrenched in this hatred of women and people of color, and self-hatred, believing that you yourself as a woman cannot or should not be in a certain position? I remember years ago when Hillary Clinton was running, and in 2016, and I was out in Indiana and doing a speech, and it was a very weird situation because the people at the speech, it was at a university, and some people were refusing to shake my hand just because I was a black woman. It was very clear. But other people ran up to me to tell me that Hillary Clinton had recently been to town. She'd been there, so this was right before the election. and she had been to town, and they had met her, and they bought her book. And I said to them, great, now are you going to vote for her? And to a person, those women looked at me, white women looked at me and said, me? Vote to put that man back in the White House? Not even a concept that she was the one going into the White House regardless of who she was married to.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and so there's a whole self-concept in the country that exceeds party. And we have to remember that up until 1968, I believe, 64, Goldwater, the Democratic Party then was the Republican Party now. The Republicans then are the Democrats now. So the pendulum swung because of allegiances to who and the Southern Dixiecrat Party and all of that. So all of that is there. We are all, in that sense, Republicans and Democrats, responsible for the history and legacy, the history we've inherited and the legacies we pass on, because that can swing back and forth at any time. All of us have to ask, why is the United States still hooked on the legacies of enslavement and the legacies of disfranchisement of women?
Well, I had journalist and author Nina Burley on just before you, and we were talking about silver lining, a sign of a silver lining here on Tuesday. Down ballot, Representative Lisa Blunt, Rochester of Delaware, and Angela Alsobrooks, the Prince George's County Executive of Maryland, both won their races for Senate, giving that chamber to black women for the very first time, which was a long-sought goal for black Democrats. Is there still silver lining there that you're seeing today?
Well, she's not the first African-American woman elected to the Senate.
It's the first two women in the chamber who happen to be African-American at the same time.
Oh, at the same time.
Yeah, for the first time.
So two out of 100. Mm. And so, yes, I'm happy that certain people... But I don't think I'm going to be frank about this. I don't think that we can just take that and say without thought, without understanding that, yes, women in the 19th century were not in elective office at all. That took the Voting Rights Act that black people put their bodies on the line for in 1965 to get blacks and women on the ballot. In any significant numbers. But this country, in that backlash that we went through and that we're going through now, forced every elected black official out of office in the 1800s. In the same period of time in which they created Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the Supreme Court decision that completely legalized segregation and unleashed a 60-year reign of terror that culminates in the civil rights era. We talk about the civil rights era, but we don't talk about what made the civil rights era necessary. So we have to stay vigilant as best we can, with an understanding of what has happened, with an understanding of the very history we're being told we don't need to know. And we do need to know our history. We do need to know that, yes, we love to say, quote Dr. King, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. But it has also contorted and turned itself around and gone back in cycles into a cultural depravity. And that's what segregation, lynching people with impunity, burning down black neighborhoods with impunity. That's Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's what that represents. So we have to know our history. We have, because then we know, wait a minute, I hear certain things that don't sound quite right. Let me not just overlook them, or let me not just first look for, oh, but it's not so bad because. Let me understand it in context.
Well,
that I can then respond as best I can under these situations. We can't all do the valiant thing. But I always urge everybody to do one thing tomorrow that you were afraid to do yesterday.
We're so glad to hear that from you. And even though we didn't get to what we had originally planned for this segment, I am so grateful and fortunate to talk to you, and our listeners are too, with your reminder about history and keeping an eye on that. And that advice there too. Janice Adams, Emmy Award-winning journalist, author, publisher and producer, and host of The Janice Adams Show here on Radio Catskill on Saturdays at 11. We're very grateful to have you here today, Janice. Thank you so much.
Thank you for welcoming me, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the latest on the drought watch that's been issued in New York State. This is Radio Catskill.
Did you know that Dolly Parton has written over 3,000 songs, including I Will Always Love You for Whitney Houston? And it also turns out that there are some impressive covers of Dolly songs by British and Irish folk singers and bands. So, please join me, Graham Rice, on the Bugaloo and Monkeys here on Radio Catskill for covers of Dolly Parton songs on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A programming note, actually, Janice Adams will be live this Saturday at 11, a live Janice Adams show to this Saturday, 11 in the morning here on Radio Catskill. Now, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation has declared a drought watch for 15 counties across the state due to significantly reduced rainfall and declining water levels in streams and groundwater. Some of those counties include counties in our area, Delaware, Sullivan, Ulster, and Orange. There are no mandatory restrictions in place under the drought watch, but the DEC is urging residents, particularly those relying on private groundwater wells, to conserve water immediately. I spoke to the New York City Deputy Commissioner of Environmental Protection, Paul Rush, about the drought watch and also the latest on the Delaware Aqueduct project.
There are different types of droughts. There's the U.S. Drought Monitor that looks at soil conditions, vegetation conditions, stream flows, and they have a map they publish indicating areas that are dry, different conditions of drought. The state looks at conditions in the state of New York and different regions to determine a drought. New York City looks primarily on the refill probability of its two largest subsystems, the Catskill system on the eastern side of the Catskills and the Delaware system on the western side of the Catskills. It looks at the refill probability of those reservoirs by the start of the next hydrologic year, which is June 1st, and generally on how we determine a drought. In the Delaware River Basin, drought conditions are dictated based on storage curves in the Flexible Flow Management Program, along with curves under the Delaware River Basin Commission's rules and regulations. And those are storages in the three New York City reservoirs that feed into the Delaware, Neversink in Sullivan County, and then Cannonsville and Papaktan in Delaware County. So there are a number of different drought indices, and conditions are dry. The state has declared a drought watch. The city has declared a drought watch for New York City. We have not yet reached the thresholds to go into drought watch conditions in the Delaware Basin. So that But with the very, very low inflows that we're experiencing, this continues, we will eventually reach those conditions. And that, you know, when that happens, that does have effects that I think your listeners will notice.
And what are some of those effects?
So in the flexible flow management program, you know, release rates from the city's reservoirs are based on forecasted inflow and forecasted diversions to New York City. So as conditions get dry, availability of water decreases. That could mean reductions in the base release rates that are released from Neversink, Papaktan, Kennesaw reservoirs. Also, right now, about two-thirds of the flow of water in the Delaware at the Montague Gauging Station just south of Port Jervis, two-thirds of that water is being released from New York City reservoirs. There's a target at Montague. In normal conditions, it's 1,750 cubic feet per second. Over the past couple of weeks, we've been releasing about two-thirds of that flow from the three upstream reservoirs, so about 1,200 CFS. And when you cross over the drought line, the target at Montague gets reduced in drought watch down about 100 CFS to 1650 CFS. And it also restricts the amount of water that New York City can divert out of the those three reservoirs outside the basin into Rondout Reservoir. We're not at that point yet, but the system, our system, the New York City system, is in a bit of an unusual configuration related to the repair of the Delaware Aqueduct that's going on right now. So we have not been taking water out of the Delaware reservoirs since shortly before October 1st.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How does this repair of the aqueduct intersect with these drought conditions?
So one thing that's 100% certain is that us doing the repair work and shutting down the aqueduct did not cause conditions to get so dry. And when we were looking at the start of the shutdown on October 1st and in September, the long-term forecast indicated there was a greater chance for wetter conditions than normal. And if you look into October and, you know, the month of October is perhaps, you know, the driest or nearly the driest month on record, particularly south, you know, to the south and east. About 3 weeks ago, the Catskills got a good shot of rain, about 0.8 inches of rain. The other part of the city system in Westchester and Putnam counties, and also a small portion of Dutchess, that watershed, the Croton watershed, did not get that rain. So in the Croton watershed, they've gotten less than 0.1 inch of rain during this period. And we're taking a large chunk of the city supply is being made up out of those reservoirs. So we're monitoring the levels in those reservoirs carefully and keeping an eye on that to make decisions on the Delaware Aqueduct and the work we're doing there. The other thing we're doing is we're maximizing our flow out of a Shokan Reservoir in Ulster County down to the city.
In the current forecast, it doesn't look like there's any significant rainfall for maybe another week. Does that concern you? And what are you looking for? And how much rain do we really need?
Those are all good questions. Being in the water supply business, I mean, water is essential to what we do. And what's happened for the past month, maybe month and a half, is we've seen forecasts for significant storms or shots of rain out in the 10-day window. And as we get closer and closer, that precipitation amount slowly decreases, and eventually we haven't really gotten much at all. And I see there's a potential for some rain out in the longer range period, 6 to 10 days. But when we're stuck in a pattern like this, I mean, oftentimes that doesn't materialize. We're concerned about that, and we have to look carefully on the work that we're doing on the Delaware Aqueduct. And that project was designed with hold points if necessary, if we run, if it appears that we may be challenged with not having enough, you know, water to go forward to complete the shutdown, that it's designed that we would be able to step out and place the aqueduct back in service if necessary to make sure we're able to meet the city. And you know, we have about 1.5 million customers of water north of the city, that primarily in Westchester County, who rely on the New York City water supply system.
And can you give us an update on how that repair is going? It's been shut down, as you said, since October 1st or so. How is it proceeding?
I mean, it's proceeding according to schedule. We've successfully dewatered most of the aqueduct at this point. We're looking to move on to the next phase of work. And we expect to go forward with it, provided there's precipitation, but we have to keep an eye on, you know, the quantity of water available. Going to Drought Watch in New York City is helpful in terms of encouraging customers to consume, and steps that city agencies are taking now to reduce consumption that gives us, a little bit more out of the supply we have. And we're careful, and what's key to move the project forward to completion is going to be dependent on getting a good shot of rain.
And in terms of conserving water, what are some things that homeowners in the regions under the drought watch can do voluntarily to help reduce water use?
I mean, at this time of the year, the growing season's largely stopped. So number one, and if it was warmer in the growing season, you want to reduce outdoor watering, restrict that. Look at reducing other outdoor uses such as washing cars. Flushing, reducing flushing is another way to save water. Toilet, there's sometimes where you can go a couple stops without flushing or reducing the amount of flushing, because that's a big use of water. Not running the tap while you're brushing your teeth and shaving, that's another way to reduce. Washing machines, dishwashers, making sure they're completely full when you use them. Don't do unnecessary cycles. And, we have a large surface water supply that relies on water from the Catskills for our customers. Folks with private wells as well, conserving that water helps to, preserve the well also in very dry times, because as groundwater is sinking, I mean, we see that in the reduction in the base flow of the streams running into the reservoir and into the Delaware, since we're releasing so much water. So that means the groundwater levels are on the decline, and everyone with a private well relies on groundwater, and people should be conscious of really looking to reduce their uses proactively, because having a well that goes dry is that's something that no one wants to experience. And if you're able to put the brakes a bit on your water use and be careful on it, I mean, that's a way to preserve groundwater levels for your well and in the area around your well.
That's Paul Rush, Deputy Commissioner for the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. Mr. Rush, thanks for joining us today.
Yep, thank you very much.
And this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Veterans Day is coming up on Monday, the 11th, honoring military veterans of the United States Armed Forces. At the Damascus Area School in Wayne County, they have made their own observation and honor for some veterans locally. It's a longstanding tradition, and here to tell us more about it is principal of the Damascus Area School, Dave Jagger. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you folks today?
We're good. Thanks for being here. And thanks for bringing us this story. Who have you honored for their service to our country?
Well, each year at the Damascus Area School, we conduct our Veterans Day program on the Wednesday before Veterans Day. Lines up in our calendar nicely to do it that way. So our program was last evening. We honored this year serviceman Fred Murray, who is a great part of the Honesdale and the Wayne County community. Currently lives in the Hawley area, down near Lake Wampaupack, but he was a Korean War veteran, served as a service member, like I said, in Korea for about 3 years, and has returned to the community after that service and started a great family, involved with many local businesses, and many of our community projects in the last number of years in the Holmesdale area. Fred had a big part in those.
And this, as you said, is a longstanding tradition. What does it mean for the students here to be able to take part in this?
Well, we have a student population of around 270 students now. And when I tell you that all 270 have a role, obviously that role is very small for some. It may be just doing a class project to thank a veteran through a letter or through a drawing or something like that. But our eighth grade students, our middle school students, we are a K-8 building. So we have many of our middle school students who have the opportunity to get involved on stage to either present different parts of our program or to act as an MC or a part of our color guard. And those roles have become really, really almost like small celebrity roles here in the school. Our students write letters to their social studies teachers to ask to apply to be a part of our onstage crew of presenters. And our four young ladies who did that this year were just spectacular. So it's been a big, long tradition for probably a couple decades now that we've taken it to this degree, where we have some of our local politicians and some of our local leadership come in to help us honor our veterans each year in Wayne County.
And you had Lieutenant Commander Jessica Wilcox of the Navy as the keynote speaker as well, joining in the ceremony.
Yeah, Jessica is a local person in our community. She was from the Calicoon area and went to school, or went to a church right here at the Damascus United Methodist Church, which is right in our backyard. So she's obviously very familiar with our community, and she lives right here near the school in the Calkins area. Jessica was a lieutenant commander in a submarine division in the Navy after her time at the Naval Academy. And so she was able to share a lot of her story about being called to serve, the experience of working with an all-female submarine crew, which was a first for the Navy. Up to that point, crews in that division were entirely men. And so she was able to be part of the leadership of that first with all female crew. And so she had some wonderful stories about that. She talked about the commitment and the time and the experience of serving. And she's in active duty. So she's on a sabbatical now, but she'll be heading back into full-time duty in January. And it was really, it's a fascinating message for our young people to hear and for our community to know that right in their backyard, they have a naval officer who's getting ready to head back into service. And so we were thrilled to be able to welcome Jessica, because she really did a spectacular job last evening.
Well, congratulations to Fred Murray, and thanks to him for his service, to Lieutenant Commander Jessica Wilcox for her service as well. And thanks to all the students at the Damascus Area School for continuing this great tradition. Dave Jagger is the principal of the Damascus Area School. Thank you so much for bringing us this great story.
Well, thank you for having us, and we'll be around next year to do it all again.
And we'll check in again. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A programming note, President Biden is expected to speak from the White House Rose Garden today in the next hour. Timing is fluid, and once we get that two-minute warning, we'll bring you NPR's live special coverage from the White House with President Biden's remarks. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Jazz Night in America, South Africa's forgotten jazz history, with music by Abdullah Ibrahim.
The only reality is a dream, because everything that you see in reality start with a dream.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, decreasing clouds and cooler, a high 59, clear low 40 tonight. Tomorrow, sunny and breezy, high 57, clear low tomorrow night, 32. And for the weekend, cooler, breezy in the morning on Saturday, sunny skies, 46 for the high, a shower in the afternoon expected on Sunday with a high of 48. On Points next, it's 11 o'clock.